The New Year journey is gathering steam. Things as they are, things as they seem. Groundhog says, is that all you got? Yes, some things have changed, many have not. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. I'm Al Ross. This is the broadcast welcome mat for the arts, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin. Big show this week. Them Cooley Boys are raising money for a new album. They're doing very well at it. We'll update you later on. We're going to talk about that and hear a pre-release sample. The Chippewa Valley Book Festival welcomes two powerhouse authors to virtual sessions with readers. And later, we'll talk with Britt Bennett, author of a couple of runaway bestsellers, the latest of which is The Vanishing Half. This year's Western Wisconsin Spring Garden Seminar is a virtual series featuring special guests. Regional Master Gardener Rep. Ellen Terwilliger has a preview of all of it, and we'll share some conversation with Melinda Myers, garden expert, media host, author, and columnist. But first, to get the show on the road, we're delighted that Catherine Thomas stopped by this week to share her exchange with Wisconsin writer Lauren Fox after reading her historical novel called Send for Me.
Send for Me, I believe, is your fourth novel, and the book cover says that it's a major departure from your other books. How so?
It kind of is and it isn't. My last three books were contemporary fiction, and this is historical fiction. And although my last three books were about heavy subjects, I mean, the last one was about a woman whose best friend dies and how she comes to terms with that, there was a sort of different tone to those three books. Because they were contemporary fiction, I think there was more humor in them, and they were, you know, a little bit lighter. And this one is about a family that is separated because of the Holocaust, so there's definitely a difference in that way. But for me, though, like, I've been thinking about this book and working on it in one way or another for, like, the past 25 years. So for me, it's more of an evolution. So it kind of is a departure, and it also isn't, because this has been kind of in my mind and in my heart for, you know, over two decades.
So it started when you found some letters in your parents' basement.
Yes. When I was in my mid-20s, my grandparents had recently died, and all of their belongings were in our basement. Going through their things, I stumbled upon a little wooden box. I still remember it had a little pink ribbon around it. And the box was full of letters, practically disintegrating onion skin paper. And I couldn't read them. They were written in this old-fashioned German script that I found out later very few people can still read. And I remember that moment so clearly. It just felt like such a sort of momentous moment. I knew that those letters were going to be significant. I didn't know why, but I just knew that they were going to answer questions that I had and they were going to be sort of a meaningful part of my life. And I was able to get them translated. I was a graduate student in Minnesota, and I found a professor in the German department who was able to read that script and so generously kind of took me on as his project. And there were about 75 letters, and I would take a couple of letters to his office once a week, and he would just read them out loud into a tape recorder, and then I would take them home and transcribe them. A long, drawn-out, and incredibly meaningful project.
Yeah, you must have been pretty busy at that time.
Yeah. What I didn't tell you, the letters were written by my great-grandmother between around 1938 and 1941, written to my grandmother, who at that time was already in Milwaukee. My great-grandparents were trying to leave Germany. The letters are her desperation and despair. They were trying to leave, and they weren't able to. So the letters, I actually incorporated them into a project that I was working on at the time. They became part of my graduate school experience.
Sure. Let's talk about those four generations of women who appear in this book.
So the book is fiction, but it's based on my family's story. So the book starts in Germany in, like, the 1930s. The first woman that we meet is Clara, and then her daughter, Annelise. I don't know if there's a main character in the book, but when I talk about it, I tend to focus on Annelise. She is a young woman, newly married, and has a baby. And as Hitler and Nazism descend on Germany in the 30s, she and her husband and child are able to leave. Her parents aren't. So that's part of the book, the experience of leaving Germany and leaving her parents behind. Then the book jumps 50 years to 1990s Wisconsin, when Annelise's granddaughter, Claire, discovers the letters, gets them translated, and meets a man and is trying to figure out sort of how to live her life and how to pry her own life away from this family history.
Mm-hmm. And the relationships between the women, they're all mother-daughter, granddaughter,
great-granddaughter. Really is the story of mothers and daughters. Like I said, like one manner or another, I've been working on it for such a long time, and it really sort of came to fruition for me after I had daughters of my own, and I realized that this story really is about mothers and daughters and the complicated and like deep relationship that they have, and just the way that bonds between mothers and daughters are so significant and how complex they can be and how intense. So I think that is very much the lens through which I'm telling this story.
And what did your mother and grandmother think about you writing the book and then having characters based on them?
My grandmother has been gone for a long time. My mother is, my mom and I are very close. And she's thrilled and proud of this book. And she'll tell me like, oh, you know, I'm reading your book again and I'm crying again. You know, this is really meaningful for her. I feel like I sort of, in addition to making this creative project and diving deeply into the fictional world, I also feel like I sort of honored my family story in this book, and I think my mom feels that strongly as well.
Mm-hmm. Author Lauren Fox joins us by phone today from her hometown of Milwaukee. We're talking about Send For Me, her newest novel. It's a work of historical fiction based on her family's history. I think about historical fiction, or if I ever thought about writing, I might be intimidated because I'd be afraid I'm going to get something wrong. It's like,
yeah.
I wasn't there. How can I really be sure what it was like and then portray it authentically? One little line from your book kind of encapsulates this for me. So one of your characters, they're asked by their American sponsors in Milwaukee, you know, tell us what it was like in Germany before you came to the United States. And the character says, you can't imagine. How do you write a convincing novel about experiences we can't fully imagine?
That's such a good question, and I was thinking as you were saying that I was so intimidated. I mean, I think that's why it took me 25 years to figure out how to write this. You know, because I felt like it needed to be a memoir. I mean, I was 25 years old, so I didn't really have that much to say about myself. But I felt like that was the only way to stay true to the story, was to use the letters, honestly use the letters in the book, and also just to write about my life. But that actually turned out to be quite boring. Well, it took a couple of people to say to me, you know, you're actually a novelist, Lauren. So it took me a while to figure out that I wanted to write historical fiction. And then I researched so much. And the more I researched, the more you sort of internalize it, the more confidence it gave me. I mean, this is such a profound subject. In a world where Holocaust denial exists, I felt extra pressure to get this right. I felt like, you know, the stakes were very high for me. So one thing is that the letters that appear in the book, they're my great-grandmother's words. I didn't change anything about those letters. And then the more I researched, the more I knew. And the internet is an amazing thing. Like, if I ever had a question about, you know, what Annalise would be wearing, I, you know, could just Google German fashion 1940s and I would find it. So, I don't know. And then just, like, getting immersed in the story, I think that's the experience that all fiction writers have. Like, when you're so deep in the story, your confidence in what you're doing just grows.
Sometimes I hear authors say, well, the characters, I thought they were going to do this, and then the story decided how the book was going to end. So your book is based on actual people. Does it mirror what actually happened, or did you change things at all?
Both. Both things are true. So the characters in the story, the family owns a bakery. My grandparents owned a butcher shop, and it also was very freeing to be able to create these characters and not feel beholden to, because, I mean, I couldn't get into my great-grandmother's head. I had to fictionalize them. The outlines of the story are my family's story, but the sort of details are fictionalized. Main things that happened, the attempts to leave Germany, my great-grandparents not being able to leave, the settling in Milwaukee, like the main outlines of the story are true, and then the details are fiction.
There was a study, a scientific study, that suggested that reading literary fiction increases our ability to empathize with others, those who are different from us especially. As I was reading your book, I definitely got that sense. All the characters were very real. It's set mostly in the recent past, but, you know, it looks at big universal themes that are timeless, you know, how to be human, how we deal with change and tragedy and the unexpectedness of life when we get things that we didn't ask for or could never have predicted or controlled. What do you think that your book says to us today?
So I started working on the book, this recent incarnation. I started working on it a couple of years ago. I mean, like I said, it's been with me for such a long time. But a few years ago when it came to light, families were being separated at the border. You know, it was so devastating to read those accounts. And I started thinking, this is the moment that I need to start writing this story again. Unfortunately, these things are still happening and the themes aren't going away. I don't know what a novel can do, but I felt like this is my moment to do what I can do with the story that I have and maybe amplify it and try to connect with people. when the galleys of the book came to my house, my daughters started reading it, and I have an 18-year-old and a 13-year-old, and I was sitting in my office, and my older daughter just started crying, and I, you know this story, what's going on? She never saw her parents again. It was this moment when she just owned our family story, and I've been thinking about that so much ever since it happened. That was a moment of total empathy for her. She just understood where we came from. And ever since then, I've been thinking, if she hears about injustice, she'll understand it on this deep level. That was a moment of connection, and maybe this book can connect for people like that.
Lauren Fox is the author of the new novel, Send For Me, which is out now, and she joins us today from Milwaukee. Lauren, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, KT, as usual. Appreciate it. Coming up on Spectrum West, Them Cooley Boys kickstart some new music, and author Britt Bennett calls in from California. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, committed to delivering an authentic and enjoyable automotive experience. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, and at MarquardtToyota.com. Support also comes from UW Health, where colon cancer second opinions mean a commitment to coordinated care, fewer trips to the hospital, and more treatment options. Fight smarter. UWHealth.org/colon. Little Willie Porter there for you. The 2021 Western Wisconsin Spring... oh, I like that word. Garden Seminar is called Growing Together, and it's virtual, featuring special guests on Saturday mornings. The first is February 20th, the last is March 13th. Ellen Terwilliger of the Eau Claire Master Gardeners has particulars, and she joined me in a recent phone trialogue with one of the guests, gardening expert, TV and radio host, author and columnist Melinda Myers. I have to think that, and maybe this is for Melinda first of all, growing things is especially nourishing during the times we're in. It has at least a few healthy benefits. You can do it alone, you can do it outside, and to watch things grow, things unfazed by at least our virus, has to be good for the soul. Have you found that throughout this weird experience we're in?
You bet. We've seen a surge of new gardeners and many experienced gardeners coming back or expanding what they're growing. I started my career back in the late 70s with indoor plants, and I'm seeing a lot of people growing indoor plants for the first time in the last 5 years, now expanding into vegetables and herbs, things they can eat, or flowers to decorate their yard. I always say, as gardeners, we know gardening is good for your mind, body, and spirit, and now there's research that bears that out. You know, you'll see articles based on research where, you know, having plants in your office reduces stress. It focuses you. So kids, too, especially with all the virtual learning, getting kids doing some garden activities is important as well because it helps them focus. It helps all of us with our creativity, reduces stress. And so there's all these good things that I think we especially needed in the last year to get us through some of the challenging times. But what I'm hoping is new gardeners find that, wow, this is a great hobby stress relief that I'm going to continue growing. And I'm seeing a lot of newbies returning to webinars and ordering seeds and doing all those things that indicate that, yes, I'm going to keep gardening because I found some joy and benefits personally and for my family and community.
Among the many discovery moments that I have in doing a show like this, One is finding out how many more associations there are in America. Well, I came across Garden Communicators International, the Garden Writers Association, the American Nursery and Landscape Association, the Perennial Plant Association. Wow.
If you have a special interest in a plant, there's the Daylily Society, the Bonsai Society, the Hosta Society. You know, when I meet gardeners that are very into one type of plant, I'm like, you need to join that group because these are people that concentrate and focus on that one type of plant. And then, of course, they're the master gardeners that are there to help you along the way.
So, Ellen, I read that this is being sponsored by 6 Western Wisconsin counties. Does each county have a master gardeners group?
Most counties in Wisconsin do have a master gardeners group. There are some up north that combine, and they're like a Northern Wisconsin association, but they share extension resources. There's no longer a horticultural educator or specialist in each county. Four or five counties go together and they share a horticulturist and somebody who helps to coordinate the Master Gardener program.
Why become a Master Gardener and how do you become a Master Gardener?
You can go out to the state Master Gardener website and it tells you how you can join. Right now with the pandemic, there are virtual classes. We just had a new group go through some horticultural training, and then they'll go through an onboarding where you get your background check and you go through the process of becoming an actual Master Gardener. So right now it's a two-step process. Becoming a Master Gardener doesn't mean you just get training. You are getting the training so you can help extend our university extension specialists. And you work in the community. It might be with a school. It might be at the farmer's market, answering questions at the Ask a Master Gardener booth. It might be helping out with a community garden, raising vegetables for food banks, any of a number of things. But the goal is that you volunteer at least 24 hours a year, giving back to the community your gardening expertise.
Ellen Terwilliger is in charge of education and a past president of the Eau Claire Area Master Gardeners and one of the coordinators of the big 2021 Western Wisconsin Spring Garden Seminar. It's coming up, and we're going to ask Ellen to give us details. Melinda Myers also on the phone, and she's one of four special guests of this special seminar. Melinda, we were talking about all of the specialties in the art, I guess we can call it an art, of gardening.
Yeah.
You are in some halls of fame. You've received many awards. It would seem the ultimate honor to me to be one who had a plant named after them. That's kind of true validation of a career.
True. I've never thought about it. You know, you have a plaque to hang on the wall, but to have a plant that's named after you, I do have a collection of plants called Melinda's Choice. They're not really named after me, but plants that I've had success that I find that work well for gardeners, great additions to the landscape. One of the garden centers I work with now, we do Melinda's Choice. And so one of my goals of my team, and I have some great people that work with me, is we just want to educate and inspire so people have fun and are successful in their gardens. You know, I've found so much joy in gardening that I want to share that with everybody. Working with the professional organizations, they help keep me up to date and, you know, what's new, what's happening, working with master gardeners, garden clubs. You know, I get an insight to what gardeners are looking for at that level. And then teaching, which I miss the in-person, but boy, webinars are a good second best. And it allows us to reach people like six counties coming together. And if it snows, it is not a problem. And in February...
The Wisconsin, West Wisconsin Spring Garden Seminar, there are a total of four beginning on February 20th. Ellen, a brief listing of all four of the presentations. You can skip Melinda's. She's on the 27th of February. We're going to give her enough ink just having been part of this. But who are the other three?
February 20th, we'll open our series with Sonia Burke, a Hennepin County Master Gardener, works at the Arboretum quite a bit. She will be talking about preparing your soil for planting vegetables. We have noticed a huge surge in interest in vegetable gardening. If you want to have good vegetables, soil is the key. Melinda will be speaking on February 27th about creating a private place. To help, the following week, we have scheduled Dr. Laura Joel, a member of the faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Horticultural Department, about how you can correctly plant trees and shrubs. And then on March 13th, we have Kelly Povo, professional photographer, photographs a lot of flower and garden-related topics. And then we have Phyllis Root, who has written over 50 books for children, a lot of them garden-related, and they're going to have an illustrated talk on searching for wildflowers in Wisconsin and Minnesota.
What an all-star lineup, and I can't think of a better name for a gardener than Root.
No, I cannot.
Melinda, your presentation is about creating a private space. What is a private space?
One of the things, whether you have a small garden, how do you create privacy when your neighbor's house is 3 feet away, or a large expand of property where you're trying to create those intimate areas? I lived in the city of Milwaukee for 26 years. I was always looking for ways to create that space that made me feel comfortable, intimate, an extension from inside going out. Now I have a larger expanse of property, and now I miss some of that intimacy. So how do I create those outdoor living spaces, you know, the rooms outside in your property? So maybe you just want a chair with some interesting plantings, maybe a few shrubs or a trellis with vines, a nice chair and table so you can take your coffee or favorite beverage and your book and go out and read. Maybe it's an area where the family gets together, but you want to kind of create it like your outdoor kitchen. Mm-hmm. And it could include a grill or outdoor kitchen amenities, but it could also just be a space, easy access inside and out, so that you can easily serve up your food. I love to include pots of herbs and some vegetables like cherry tomatoes and peppers and greens so that I can hand them a plate and say, go make your own salad. Or here's some basil on the table, some sage, some chives, dress it up the way you want. Really, it's like creating an extra room for your house. And the good news is there's a lot of garden furnishings that will help with that. So there's lots of different ways of creating that space and repeating color and texture from maybe the inside out so it looks like it's part of your home.
Ah, I know that Melinda mentioned children early on in the conversation. How are we doing getting young people interested?
From Eau Claire, there's a number of school gardens, mm-hmm. and then we have several master gardeners who work with a youth garden combined with the Boys and Girls Club. Kids throughout the summer come and have different educational and hands-on experiences in that garden down on Forest Street.
And from a national perspective, kids gardening has a lot of curriculum for teachers, but also for families to use. We do a kids gardening tip every month in our newsletter, radio tips as well. It's great if you can help a school garden or a youth group in your community. But if you're feeling overwhelmed, if you have just one youngster in your life, a neighbor, your own children, nieces, nephews, and you give them a pot with flowers and vegetables, that could be the next horticulturist. That could be that one thing that helped that child get through these challenging times.
Yeah.
You know, we all can make a difference, one garden and one gardener at a time.
Melinda and Ellen, thanks. All the best going forward, and have a wonderful seminar.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us on, Al.
And listen to this. All four Saturdays, all four special guests, it's going to cost you a whopping $10. Wow. Register today at the website EauClaireAreaMasterGardener.org. You'll receive a link to each presentation the week before it happens. You're listening to Spectrum West. A bit later, a couple of them Cooley Boys. But right now, a Chippewa Valley Book Festival, as you might expect, finds ways to make reading as wonderful and inspiring as it can possibly be. The festival continues to evolve in times that demand evolution and innovation. And next Friday, February 12th, you'll have the opportunity to meet one of the brightest young stars in today's literary sky. Britt Bennett has written two novels, The Mothers and The Vanishing Half. Both have been at the top of bestseller lists. You are going to interact with her next week, but here's a prelude. I'm curious about a lot of things, and we'll touch on many of those. Any other writers in your family tree? Where did this talent come from?
I have an aunt who does write poetry, but other than that, it's just kind of the two of us. But my mom was the big reader in the house. She was the one who got me into books.
You had some success even in college and graduate school. You won some awards. Athletes in college, you know, they dream of playing professional sports. So I thought, I'm going to ask Britt if writers dream of bestsellers. Did you have lofty aspirations?
I think I just wanted to publish a book. I don't think I really thought beyond that point. The idea of being a bestseller was totally inconceivable to me. The idea of seeing my name on, you know, the cover of a book someday and publishing a book that people who didn't know me would read, not just my family or friends. I think that was as far as really my vision for my future went.
Continuing on that concept for just a little bit, of course, bestseller means that lots and lots and lots of people are enjoying your book. As an author, and you know that that's happening, how do you think, or do you think, let's go with how do you, because I'm going to take it for granted that you do. How do you think about all of us out here digesting your work? I've asked this of other writers over the years. Do you think about the people reading your stuff? Do you picture them doing that?
Yeah, I think now in the time, this kind of age of social media, it's something that I think about, I think, a lot more than maybe sort of previous generations of writers where you kind of send the book off into the world and you maybe have a little bit more of a disconnect from the readers. You know, for me, I hear back from readers all the time. I get tagged by readers who are reading the book. People tell me what they felt and thought reading the book. So there is kind of that direct connection. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, in this moment in particular, it's been actually really nice to hear from readers and to also see the book going out into the world at a time in which I cannot really go out into the world. So it's been nice to be tagged in all of these different locations throughout the world as I'm, you know, still at home.
Your label as bestseller, of course, means you have to do a lot more of what you're doing right now, right?
Yeah, I've been pretty busy since June.
So now you were talking about people reaching out to you and you talking to people who have read your stuff. Does it humor you sometimes when you watch or hear about people getting different impressions or seeing things and characters in different ways? Secondarily, is that kind of a sign of success for a writer, that you're making people think in different ways?
I think so. I think if readers have any reaction to a character that makes me feel good, even if they hate a character. I think one of my first experiences with my debut novel was when I first got early copies and I gave them to my parents. My parents had never read the book before. And I happened to go downstairs and heard them arguing about one of the characters in the book. And they just had really wildly divergent opinions on this character. And it was so surreal to see my parents talking about these characters that had just been living inside my brain for all these years.
Yeah.
It was also really validating to hear them have opinions on these characters in the way that we have opinions on people in real life.
Uh-huh. Let's go back to college just very briefly. I'm curious about any best advice that any of your college mentors might have handed out.
I think for me, a lot of it was psychological. A lot of it was about teaching me how to get out of my own way as I was trying to complete a novel. I think one of the biggest parts of writing a novel is just the psychological work it takes to return to a long project day after day and feel bad about it for a lot of the time. If it's not bad the whole time, then it's something that is disappointing to you. It's not as good as you want it to be. So the kind of psychological work it takes to return to something like that day in and day out for years, I think that that's one of the things I'm really most grateful for my college mentors and helping me learn how to push through that kind of constant disappointment in your own work in order to keep working on something and make it better.
Do you think about them as well as you try to cope, is the only word I can come up with at the moment, with your newfound fame? Do you think about them standing next to you saying, now don't let this go too far to your head?
Oh, I think, you know, I think a bit. It's hard to kind of separate, I think, the act of writing a novel without thinking about the people who have helped instruct you and helped you learn, you know, whether it's craft or whether it is the kind of psychological work that it takes to write a novel. So I think I carry, you know, all of my teachers with me. I carry my family, my friends. I carry everybody with me when I think about, you know, facing the page again and trying to kind of go to battle with my own self-consciousness and all of the things it takes in order to create a piece of art.
On the phone with Britt Bennett. She is one of the guests of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival, a virtual affair. Her appearance is Friday, February 12th at 7 p.m. Britt, of course, the author of The Mothers back in 2016. And most recently, both bestsellers, by the way, The Vanishing Half. You know, Britt, they always say that it's tougher to stay on top than to get on top. I'm curious about the mindset of one who sets out to write her second novel while still basking in the glow of the first one. What's the secret of a good writer relative to putting things in the rearview mirror and then moving on to something new and different? Because I heard you say in an interview that you'd been working on The Vanishing Half for about 4 to 5 years. So there's also got to be, I'm guessing, maybe some juggling involved. Can you work on two big projects at the same time? I'm sorry, there's too many questions there.
Well, I think for me, in The Vanishing Half, I started working on that book as I was kind of finishing The Mothers. So
Okay. There
was a slight overlap, but it was kind of the next project that I worked on. And yeah, I mean, I think it was definitely challenging to write a second novel because I had never written a second novel before.
Mm.
And important thing about that, I think, is just that it's always humbling to sit down and start a new project, even after your previous project was successful, because when you sit down to face the blank page, it doesn't matter what you've done before. You know, none of that really matters. If you got good reviews or if you wrote a bestseller, you're still looking at a blank page again. So
yeah.
I think it's both humbling in a really important way to jump into that next project, but I also think it's important to Or at least it was important for me to tell myself, you know, you've never written a second novel before. Each book requires something completely different from you. So it's okay that you feel completely unmoored and really lost at how to make your way through this book. That's a natural thing to feel, even though you have published a book before.
I run the risk of labeling myself as somebody who likes the pictures more than the words of any given book. But I have to ask about the covers of your books. They are really unique, kind of a bit similar in their abstract and colorful way. I do believe that publishers prescribe the outward appearance of their releases. Can you tell me anything about the covers?
Yeah, I was very lucky that I had, you know, two beautiful covers designed for both my books that I think, as you said, they kind of call back to one another in a way, which I also really love.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't know because I've been publishing for a pretty short time, but it feels like now that the covers do really matter in a way because of the internet, social media, and what people are going to post on Instagram, and all of those things seem to go into making an eye-catching cover. I feel really lucky that I ended up with these really beautiful covers. I think this was one of the, if not the first, for The Vanishing Half, one of the first concepts that I saw. And I know with The Mothers, that was the first concept that they tried out for the cover. Some really great artists, and I feel, lucky that I have these both beautiful covers.
Yeah, no kidding. Mm-hmm. I think if it was repeated, it would make a really good shower curtain, a fashion fabric. I was thinking also about book festivals over the weekend. While you do see music festivals and art festivals and Renaissance festivals and food festivals, you just don't see plumbing festivals or urology festivals. So you're fortunate to have a job that honors your product with festivals, even though you can't be there in person. Your books have introduced you to a whole lot of people you never would have met had you been working on a widget assembly line. People who run book festivals will say, man, there's a wonderful facet to the virtual side, and we'll continue doing that in some way. But it is kind of cool, isn't it, to get out there and meet the people and shake their hands and hand a book to them after signing it?
Yeah, I definitely miss book festivals. I think the experience of meeting readers and talking to readers is great, and also the experience of meeting other writers, just as a person who likes reading books. There's always that part of you that's a fan where you meet a writer that you admire. So I definitely miss those. I'm glad, as you said, that the book world has found a way to continue in this virtual format. And I'm glad that these events have become more accessible to people who don't always live in places where publishers send authors. But I'm definitely looking forward to a point where we can gather again at a book festival, and meet each other face-to-face.
That brings to mind like the beginning of a joke. Two writers meet on the street. what do writers talk about when they get together?
I think different things. You know, I've been fortunate to be able to go to book festivals in a lot of different places. So it's always one of my favorite things is who you run into in the lobby of a hotel, or, you know, going to dinner after or getting a drink after. So, of course, there's always the conversation about books and writing and those kind of typical things. But, a lot of it is just sometimes you end up in a kind of random town or a random country and you're just kind of exploring there. It has a little bit of a summer camp vibe almost when you're at a book festival, where you just kind of end up there and now you're in a cab with these two writers and you're going to a place and you just kind of go with it. So I definitely miss those. I've been very lucky to be able to go to some cool places and meet some very cool writers.
Yeah, and if you're sitting next to one and you really don't know them, you still have to say, oh, yes, I know your work.
I loved your book, yeah.
So, of course, at the Chippewa Valley Book Festival session on Friday the 12th at 7 o'clock it begins. They'll be talking mostly about The Vanishing Half, the story about twin sisters. I'm trying to give people an hors d'oeuvre because from the time this interview airs until that evening, the 12th, people have more than enough time to read it. So without giving anything away to one who hasn't read it, does the title hold an hors d'oeuvre of any kind for people?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, The Vanishing Half is a story about twin sisters who decide to live their lives on opposite sides of the color line. The book is a lot about identity and family and what it means to transform from one person into a different person.
I saw that you have written lots of essays, and they have been published in some very prestigious publications. I don't know why, but for some reason I thought of a golfer on a driving range. I'm curious about the role that essays play in the life of a writer. Kind of like going to the driving range, you just have to continue writing even if you're not working on something of a grander scale?
that I enjoy. I think it really depends on the writer, because I think there can be a pressure for particularly novelists or fiction writers to write essays. And I know many who hate doing that. For me, it's something that I do enjoy. I think it requires a different side of the brain. It requires kind of a different skill set for you to exercise in order to write, you know, nonfiction instead of, you know, working in the realm of kind of pure imagination. And I also think that there's something really rewarding about writing an essay that's shorter. You get that sense of completion and that sense of finality that's different than working on a novel for 5 years.
Yeah.
So I think it can be rewarding in all of those ways. But I think the thing that I do enjoy about fiction and writing novels is being able to take my time and figure out what I think about something. I think often with nonfiction, there can be more of a pressure to write something that's relevant or something that is in the news. So I think I enjoy both forms. I think it does require something different of you, but I think it's always good for me as a writer to be able to kind of exercise that skill set and try both forms.
Britt Bennett, author of The Mothers and The Vanishing Half, and who knows what else. Hey, congratulations on the HBO deal.
Thank you.
And congratulations on achievements in your young career. I know it's not polite to mention a lady's age. I mean, you're all of 30 years old, so you've got a long way to go. We're looking forward to your next work. Are you working on something?
Thank you. Yeah, I am. I'm working on my next novel. Still very early on, but like I said, it's tumbling and also exciting to be at the beginning stage of something new.
Wonderful. Thank you for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for consenting to participate in the Chippewa Valley Book Festival. There's lots of people excited to meet you that way. Please keep in touch with us. We're going to enjoy following your career.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Everything you need to know about her appearance, cvbookfest.org. This is Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, offering fixed-rate mortgages, bridge loans, construction loans, and more. Loan officers Dawn and Susie are dedicated to providing personalized service. Charterbank.bank, invested in partnerships. Support also comes from the Frozen River Film Festival, a virtual documentary festival screening films about the environment, adventure, global culture, and more. From the 10th through the 14th, frff.org. And support also comes from Carroll University. The MS in Educational Leadership Program is designed to prepare educators for administrative leadership roles in PK through 12 schools. More at carrollu.edu. Let's do this. Ah, there we go. There isn't a hotter Western Wisconsin musical act than them Cooley Boys, ambassadors for all the talent that travels from here to play in normal times for large crowds. From cruise ships to music festivals to recording sessions, these guys have found their calling. They make the most of it.
Do you remember? Look in my eyes. Late September, when the summer dies, and turns to fall.
Yes, sirree, them Cooley Boys. Soren Staff writes the songs, sings them, and plays guitar and keys, and brother Gents adds strong mandolin and vocals. One review that I read, here's the quote, four-part harmony learned in dive bars and church basements. So that makes me curious, which one of those places is more conducive to getting those harmonies right?
I mean, like, I feel like you got to lay the basis in the church basement. You can't just start at the bar. Like, you have to be, you know, me and Gents were both in, like, the church choirs growing up and did all that stuff. Some of that was with our dad, you know, some of it was just with us. But, yeah, I definitely think you got to start in the church and go to the bar. You got to have that, like, that fundamental layer, and then the alcohol just helps afterward.
Yeah, when you start singing along to Journey or something like that, you really learn when you start singing along to the classics.
Yeah, you can sing in a choir and sing along to Journey, and they both get you to the right place.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, see, it's a true combination. You guys could be politicians as well. Good for you. So you just mentioned growing up. I'm curious, because it doesn't say anywhere where you grew up. I'm guessing that you grew up in what's called the Cooley region somewhere. Does the band consider anywhere a hometown?
Well, we're all based in Eau Claire right now, but me and Gents grew up outside of, like, I'm trying to think of a big enough town. in Jackson County, you know, went to school in Blair. We lived in the country off outside of Hixton, off of 94 there.
Oh, sure.
And then, you know, our banjo player, Bo, he grew up in Tremplo, and that's the heart of the Coulee region.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, I mean, that's where the name is generally coming from, because we all kind of grew up there. But when it came time to, like, find a home base, Eau Claire just kind of made sense for us.
Over the weekend, I had more time than I needed, and I discovered there's Coulee, there's canyons, there's draws, but that's the western version of ravine, and there's arroyos.
Mm.
You could have been them canyon boys or them arroyo
yeah,
boys, and I think Coulee sounds the best.
Yeah, I think it rolls off the tongue a little better.
Yeah, it does roll off the tongue. It originated, our buddy, who was also from that Tremplo area, me, Bo, and Jens, we were all counselors at a summer camp. Whenever we would get into stuff we weren't supposed to begin into, he'd be like, hey, it's them Coulee boys getting at it again. He knew where we were from, and he was from there, too. Then we started playing tunes, and it was like, hey, we need to call ourselves something, and that kind of made sense.
He was in the band for 2 weeks, never played a show or came to a practice, but he was in the band for about 2 weeks. He got put on a t-shirt even.
Yeah. Yeah, some guys just have that charisma, I guess.
I had to move to a small town in Wisconsin before I experienced that term that makes English teachers cringe, which is them.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's what people say about your music. You know, the songs on that new album by those guys, them are good.
Yeah.
That would make sense, yeah.
I got to bring up the Avett Brothers first. Bless you guys for mentioning them, because I was unaware of them. And then secondarily, damn you, I'm mildly obsessed with them now. And
what a great band, yeah.
I've even ordered their documentary. They were kind of the catalyst. Tell me about the birth of songs that you guys do. I know Soren does most or all of the writing, but then what happens? Do the other guys have to sign off on it? Do they all add something musically? What goes on?
Yeah, we like to say Soren brings the skeleton, and then we put the flesh and everything else on it.
I do a lot of my work putting the words and the form and the melody together, but you can only get it to a certain point. And that's when, you know, the other influences come in. And it's a fun process, because I'll have songs that are kind of small little folk songs, and they turn into these rock and roll kind of things that wouldn't exist without these other guys. And that's the beauty of being in the band, I think. You kind of have to give over some of that creativity to someone else. That takes some vulnerability, that takes some trust, and we've been working with these guys for a long time. It's there, so we trust them. Feels good.
Yeah. On the phone with Jens Staff and Soren Staff. They are a certain percentage, them Coulee boys, and they are initiating a Kickstarter campaign for a new album, and we're going to get into that in just a minute. But I'm having fun just yakking with them, and we'll continue that for a bit. So, gents, why is it big guys always play the smallest instruments? You know, guys, how does a guy whose fingers are kind of brat-like play the mandolin?
Well, I'm not sure if I need to take that as a compliment or an insult. But
No, it's a compliment. I'm saying that you're a very strong, manly guy.
I actually almost had no choice in it. I'd always wanted to learn a stringed instrument, and then Soren sold an electric guitar and bought a mandolin. They said, hey, learn this one. And over the summer, I learned it and then forced into playing in a band with this instrument, you know, kind of thing. But I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. I encourage people to go to the photos section of your website. You have some wonderful photographs in the joint.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. We love the J, and we love everybody there. And when it came time to do shoots and promo ones for that record, we're like, we got to go there. We got to hang out.
I saw the video from The Mask, sort of wondered where those sandwiches came from.
I think it was Jimmy John's.
Jimmy John's? Yeah.
We don't have the biggest budget, so, you know, it made sense to go there.
You guys yeah. also enlist the services of some very interesting percussion. You got hands doing things like sandpaper, and you do a lot of stomping and stuff. That's got to be a lot of fun to incorporate. Does that happen spontaneously, or does someone say, ooh, listen to this?
It honestly started as kind of like a necessity. You know, before we had a full-time drummer in the band, it was the four of us with like acoustic instruments. So
sure.
We used to do a kick drum, but there's only so much noise that can put out. And we would stomp, we would clap, whatever. That kinetic energy really resonates with the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
If they can see that you're into it and you're stomping and you're clapping, they're going to do the same thing. And with that song where you're talking about rubbing the hands like sandpaper, that was kind of an image in my head. I said, hey, what's a good way to connect? What's a good way to get these people participating besides just singing it? That's one of our favorite songs to play live, just because you're connecting with the audience in a way you're not generally doing.
And if you're playing outside on a cool night, it's a good way to get warm.
Yeah, exactly.
After holding a cold beer for too long.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's dive into the Kickstarter campaign. Three albums to your credit. This is the fourth. It's called Namesake. We've already heard a little bit of something from that album, and we're going to hear a little bit more. Tell us about the campaign, because I believe it just kicked off, correct?
Yeah, we've launched it on Monday, and we've had like an incredible response so far. People kind of coming out of the woodwork and saying they want to support this project. It's super expensive to make a record.
Yep.
You know, you have to record it. You have to pay for the person that's recording it. You have to pay for the space. You have to mix it and master it. Outside all that, you got to make the CDs. You got to make the vinyl. And then on our end, we're wanting to get some marketing behind this. So we're paying for like a national promoter and a PR campaign. And it all adds up. But we are just so excited about these songs. You know, it's the only thing we could really do this past year. When it became a reality that, you know, we were going to need some help to put it out, we thought this would be the best way to do it.
Sure.
It just offers our fans and people who care about us an opportunity for them to essentially be a record label. You know, that we're not going through someone else. We're asking people to support us, and we reward them with, you know, different levels of rewards for how much they support us. It's really a fan-centric way to support the bands and creators you care about. And
mm-hmm.
We're just excited about it. With this, we're essentially founding our own record label. We're still landing on a name, but just a fun thing to think about, because that isn't something, you know, a few dudes in their basements ever thought they'd be doing, which is founding a record label.
No kidding. Gents, tell us about the impact 2020 had on you. You had quite a reduction in live shows, did you not?
Yeah. I mean, we were prepared for 2020 to be our biggest year yet. Had a great start to the year. Like January, February, we had awesome tours. We actually played on a cruise ship for a week.
Wow.
And that was incredible. And then all that just kind of got whisked out the window. We couldn't play anymore. We had all this time that we're not used to. And, you know, for the first part of it, it was nice, where we had all summer to be home a lot. Like Thorne and I picked up golfing this summer. We couldn't be on the road.
Cool.
And actually, that's one of our rewards, is you can go golfing with us if you want.
I'm going to find that category, and I'm going to donate, because I love golf. We need an indoor driving range.
We go way over our goal. That'll be the next project.
Yes, I was going to say that. Soren Staff with us, gents on another line. They are members of Them Cooley Boys. Kickstarter campaign for a new album. They're looking forward to many more good years, beginning with 2021. You guys want to give a shout-out? You've mentioned Bo a few times. Shout-out to the other guys in the band?
Yeah, we have Stash Hobley. He plays drums for us. This is his first record playing all the percussion, and it sounds awesome. He's got such a great feel, and he's got such a great mind for what we're trying to do. He was doing all kinds of fun stuff in the studio, played some dulcimer, which mm-hmm. we've never had, chimes. We had some just really fun stuff going on. Then we have Neil Kraus. He's our bass player, and Neil's been with us for like 4 or 5 years. He was a fan of ours in another band, and when that band ended, he joined us. Me, Jensen, Bo, that's where it all started. But, you know, through the years, we've added multiple people, and it all just kind of adds to what we're trying to do.
From the upcoming album, Phil's song kind of sounds like a dedication to me.
It really is. I lost a friend of mine, not in 2020, but the year before that. And Jens was a great friend of Phil's, too. And Bo, our banjo player, grew up with Phil in a way, too. Also in 2020, me and Jens lost our grandfather. Grieving looks so differently. You're able to lean on being with the people you care about, and we weren't able to be with them. I've always wanted to make a song for Phil, and every other time it came out sad, and that just wasn't the guy that he was. So when Bo came to me with this one riff and a few of the opening lines, I was like, this is it. We have to make this a celebration, and I really think that comes across for sure.
Jensen, Soren, thanks a lot. It's been fun. Good luck with the Kickstarter campaign.
Hey, thanks, Al. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Beloved, we have gathered around this phone call. Can I?
So there you go. There's a taste of something from their new album, Namesake. It's called Phil's Song. Yeah, oh man, you know, we went from a shaky start and ended strongly. Apologies for, you know, electronics is supposed to work, isn't it? When it doesn't, I don't know. Almost swore there for a minute. By the way, them Cooley Boys have some outdoor dates planned in 2021. Everything you need to follow them online is at themcooleyboys.com. Here's an update on the Kickstarter campaign. As you heard in the interview, it started on Monday. Well, 55 hours later, they reached their original goal. And there's now a stretch goal campaign through the end of February, so you can still get involved and rake in some perks. You can access Kickstarter from most of their social media platforms, or an easy way, simply go to helptcb.com. I hope that's all still in effect. Got to keep that finishing strong thing going. Well, that's it for this week. For now, thanks to Kate, Dean, Catherine, and you. Visit us at WPR.org to find all the Spectrum West programs neatly archived. Wear a mask, keep your eyes on the road, and make a positive difference. And come on back next week for another CD from another neighbor, an art exhibit with powerful relevance, and more. Always more. Thanks, guys. Bye now.